From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. What a program we have in store for you today. If you have to work tomorrow morning, oh boy, you better take a little nap at the desk tomorrow because you're going to be up all night. Later tonight, was the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind the real deal? Here's what's happening. Iran has called U.S. sanctions economic warfare and said that there could be no talks with the United States until the sanctions are lifted, a day after Washington suggested it could hold talks without preconditions if Iran changed its behavior. We'll see what happens there. The music industry has changed dramatically since Apple disrupted the way people buy songs and albums nearly two decades ago. So Apple is phasing out iTunes, folks, in favor of three more modern apps. Apple has announced that iTunes will be replaced by a trio of desktop apps called Music, TV, and Podcasts, similar to how those services are already divided on iPhones and iPads. Quest Diagnostics said the personal information of nearly 12 million customers has been potentially compromised. The clinical laboratory company said in a release that an unauthorized user gained access to a system used by the American Medical Collection Agency. Primarily, when you go to get a blood test, it's Quest Diagnostics that does all the work, so your information could have been with them. Let's check in with Lauren Weinstein, our expert on the Internet. Lauren, lots of things I want to talk with you about tonight. And, of course, you're going to be on for a full show next Tuesday. I'm looking forward to that.
Right. I wanted to say something about Apple's announcements today.
Yeah.
There's a real great one buried in there. They announced a $5,000 Pro monitor. $5,000. It doesn't include a stand. If you want the stand for the monitor, that's an extra $999.
Jeez, throw it in. Make us seem like we're getting a deal, huh?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you can get it, I guess Apple's always figured they charge a premium, and their customers will pay for a $1,000 monitor stand. Very impressive. The thing about this Quest Diagnostics story is that there's basically no information. They're saying that they were notified that sometime between August 1st of last year and March 30th of this year, there was unauthorized access to their billing, to their third-party billing system. It was an outside vendor that does their billing. So that's credit card information, general medical information, social security numbers perhaps, good stuff like that. They are saying that because that system was an outside system, it's not tied to the diagnostic system per se, so detailed medical results, like from the blood tests themselves, the actual blood test diagnostics, would not have been involved. But beyond that, nothing. I mean, they're not saying who was affected. They're not saying how the data was accessed. They're not saying if the data was actually accessed. I mean, one of the problems that comes up in a lot of these cases is that it's discovered that a data store of some sort is open to the public. Often this happens, and I'm not saying that's this case, but someone will have an Amazon system that they're storing data on, and there's no password on it. So someone will discover that it's open, and they'll report it. That doesn't necessarily mean that anybody actually accessed it and took the data and did bad things with it. Sometimes you can figure that out through auditing after the fact and using those kinds of techniques. Sometimes you can't.
What does somebody want that information for anyways? What are you going to look at, somebody's blood test?
Well, I think in this case, because apparently the attack was on the third-party billing vendor, it was probably someone just going after the usual financial information.
The credit cards and things like that.
Yeah, and it just happened in this case that the particular customer was the medical diagnostics company. A lot of times, though, it doesn't make any sense at all from the outside why someone wants information. A lot of these attacks come from China, and apparently China just likes to collect a lot of information on Americans.
That's amazing.
A lot of times there's these attacks, and they don't ever seem to be used. It's not like the credit cards start being charged against or anything. It's like China's just accumulating this massive dossier on Americans.
On everybody.
Yeah, and you kind of wonder, what do they have in mind? And unfortunately, these kinds of situations, the amount of information we get, you know, whether it's China or anybody else, consumers who are caught in these basically have nothing to go on but you know, just to hope, and sometimes they'll eventually get a notice that says they're being offered, you know, free credit monitoring services or something.
And what's your take on the potential attack on Google and Amazon by the government?
Well, we're going to have to see what they do. I mean, this is not the first time that these firms, you know, Google in particular, has already undergone, you know, some of these kinds of government investigations. From the FTC, for example. It's, you know, a lot of this is politics. I'm not saying there isn't, you know, real issues that need to be considered, but there's nothing better to get a headline one day than just kind of getting out there and saying, yeah, I'm going to investigate big tech and I'm going to break up big tech. Well, yeah, there's stuff that needs to be fixed for sure all over the place. My personal view is that usually when politicians touch technology, you end up in a worse place than you were when you started. That's always the case, but politics and technology don't usually mix in a way that's good for consumers.
Talk to you next week, okay?
Definitely. Thank you, sir.
Full program. Lorne Weinstein will be talking with us about the dark web, 5G, artificial intelligence, virtual reality as well. An incredible story in the news at coasttocoastam.com. A picture of a double asteroid zooming by Earth at 43,000 miles an hour, captured in a truly amazing photograph. Go take a look at it. It zipped by last month. We've talked about that, but it's a great picture. Stephen Cates, our astronomer, Dr. Sky with us. What do you have for us this week, Doc?
Well, hi there, George. I'm right at my own observatory here in Phoenix, and I thought it appropriate, George, to spend a good amount of our segment here talking about the live sky. What I'm doing, George, is being the eyes of Coast to Coast right now, with your okay.
Yes, sir.
I'm taking a look at Jupiter through a rather massive telescope. By the way, folks, this planet is rising just after sunset in the southeast. And, George, it comes to opposition. We call this term, actually the term means that the object rises at sunset and stays in the sky all night. That happens on the 10th. So Jupiter right now, George, as I'm looking at about 300 times the magnification of the eye, I'm seeing distinct detail in both the bands and the belts on Jupiter. Three of the four Galilean satellites I'm watching on the far western side, George, is Callisto. Then moving on to the eastern side, I can see Europa and Ganymede. And you know, George, Ganymede is actually larger than the planet Mercury. But the interesting thing is the satellite Io is now behind the planet Jupiter. And folks, if you have a telescope during this particular time period, in about 20 minutes, you'll see, George, you will see the satellite Io reappear on the eastern edge of the planet Jupiter. By the way, 398 million miles away, it takes light some 35 minutes, George, to get from the planet itself to us. Just a spectacular object to see with the naked eye. It looks super bright. Binoculars, yeah, you can actually see the satellites of Jupiter with a steadily handheld pair of binoculars. And, George, there's always so much to talk about. Dr. Sky reminds everyone, naturally, to always remember to keep your eyes to the skies. And email me if you've got questions. We've got answers at drskyshow@gmail.com. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Dr. Sky. It's the 100th anniversary of Einstein's theory of relativity. And up next, Matthew Stanley, author of Einstein's War, joins us. It's an incredible story, and you'll be part of it on Coast to Coast AM. And let me tell you about our guest, Matt Stanley, a professor of history of science at New York University's Gallatin School of Individualized Study. Now, he holds degrees in history, astronomy, physics, and religion. He explains physics to non-scientists in his podcast, What the If?, and has appeared in documentaries on the History Channel, BBC, and NPR. His book, Einstein's War, How Relativity Triumphed Amid the Vicious Nationalism of World War I. Matt, welcome to the program. I'm looking forward to this one.
Thank you very much.
I can't believe it's been 100 years since Einstein's theory.
It is kind of hard to believe, right? It seems so. Einstein is always with us, right? It doesn't seem right that he's a whole century ago.
And he did all this without the aid of a computer.
That's right. Yeah, back in Einstein's era, the word computer was a person. It was a person who was doing math, and they would sit there 10 hours a day and crank out the numbers.
Had he had a computer then that was working like they do today, how quickly would he have been able to move up his theories?
Well, it would have kept him from making some mistakes that slowed him down for a couple of years.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the big problems in relativity are conceptual ones. That is, they're not calculational ones. It's not about the 1 plus 1 equals 2. It's about figuring out the meaning of the symbols and the deep truths kind of hidden beyond the ideas.
Now, what inspired you to write Einstein's War? Tell us about the title.
So there's actually two wars being talked about in the title there. One is World War I, the Great War, which was actually Einstein's most productive scientific period. He publishes more in those 4 years than in any other period in his life. And then the second war is his struggle to finish his theory of relativity and convince the world that it's true. And these two wars are sort of, you know, the second one is metaphorical, of course, but they're intertwined. That is, Einstein's struggle to finish relativity and persuade the world about it is deeply tied with the actual war going on in Europe at the time.
Now, he was born in the German Empire in 1879. At what point in his life was he really into the science and the physics of this?
Well, the story that Einstein himself tells is when he was a little kid, something like 5 or 6, he was homesick one day, and to cheer him up, his father brought him a compass. And as Einstein tells the story, he's amazed by the compass because the needle always points in the same direction, no matter what you do, right? You can turn the compass upside down, you can spin it around, it always works the same way, and there's always this invisible force that pulls the needle just so. And he decides he wants to know more about that. He wants to know about the invisible forces in the universe.
And at that point, of course, was he working alone? Did he have a staff? How many people around him?
Well, Einstein is, there are different phases of his life. So when he's a young man, sort of just finishing college, he gets his job at the patent office. He has a group of friends, including his wife and a handful of folks who he gets together with to talk about physics and philosophy. And he's always bouncing ideas off of these people. So his early work, the work that sort of culminates in his miracle year of 1905, comes out of these conversations with his friends. And then that gets him some notoriety, and he gets some more high-profile friends. So he always thinks of himself as being an individualist, but really he always needs this group of friends around him to keep him honest, to tell him when he has bad ideas, to give him suggestions when he needs it, and at the end of the day, to do things that he isn't very good at doing.
In 1933, Einstein was visiting the United States. That's when Adolf Hitler came to power in Germany. Einstein had a Jewish background, of course, and did not, I believe, return to Germany at that time. He stayed in the United States, didn't he?
That's right. He actually he's in the United States when the Nazis come to power, and the Nazis literally plunder his home in Berlin and destroy his book collection and such. And he never returns to Germany. He actually travels around a little bit before he settles in New Jersey at the Institute for Advanced Study, which is a place they set up just to give Einstein a home.
Was he wealthy? Did he have money?
He was growing up, he was solidly middle class. And then as a young man, when he was struggling to get a job, he always had trouble with money. And then his real money woes hit him during and after World War I. So he's being paid in German marks. And the German currency gets hugely devalued by the war and the inflationary spiral afterwards. So he's always desperate for hard cash for most of his life.
So it was Oppenheimer, of course, who came up with the atomic bomb. But didn't Einstein have a lot to do with that, too?
He did, and I should say this is a really kind of an extraordinary moment for Einstein because he's a lifelong pacifist and internationalist. He thinks war is the most terrible sort of thing that humanity can do to each other.
He's probably right.
Yeah, that's right. And during World War I, he fights against the war as strongly as he can, and he devotes himself to causes of peace. But then, as you say, after 1933, he's chased from his home, and the Nazis are terrifying. Tim, and he's horrified at the possibility that the Nazis might be able to build an atomic bomb before the Allies did. So he writes a letter to FDR, to President Roosevelt, alerting him to this possibility that the Nazis might get this bomb. And this letter essentially jumpstarts what becomes the Manhattan Project. And this haunts Einstein for the rest of his life. So after the end of the war, he returns to his work for nuclear disarmament, for world peace. It's really you can only imagine the kind of heart-rending this must have been for him.
But you know, had he not done what he did, had he not sent that letter, there's no question that the Germans would have beaten us with that bomb, and they would have won the war.
It's quite possible. This is something that historians argue about a lot, as whether the Germans, if they'd been left alone, could have built a bomb on their own. It's very complicated. So Heisenberg, for instance, is in charge of part of the Nazi bomb project, and he claims after the war that he was trying to sabotage the bomb project. And the evidence for that is a little shaky, but it's hard to tell.
Now, the subtitle of your book is How Relativity Triumphed Amid the Vicious Nationalism of World War One. And what do you mean by vicious nationalism?
Well, right at the start of the war, scientists and intellectuals in general, I should say, go right into their nationalist camps. That is, British scientists say they'll never send any journals to German scientists. German scientists say they'll never cite an English paper again. They refuse to invite each other to scientific conferences, to use each other's languages. So the scientific community, which up until 1914 had been extremely international, I mean, really a globalized sort of thing in a very early era, quite suddenly falls into these nationalistic camps, and it becomes very difficult for scientists to communicate across borders.
Interesting take. Now, with this being the 100th anniversary of the 1919 eclipse that proved Einstein's theory of relativity, explain how an eclipse was able to prove that theory. What happened?
Sure. So Einstein's theory of relativity makes a prediction that gravity should affect light. So, you know, we think about light going in straight rays.
Right.
But if relativity is right, then a sufficiently massive body like the sun, that body's gravity will actually pull the rays around in a curve instead. So you can see this if you're looking. So imagine you're standing on the surface of the Earth and you're looking at the sun, and there's a star just past the edge of the sun. The ray of light coming from that star will be slightly distorted by the sun's gravity. And from your point of view, that star will be in the wrong place in the sky because of the curvature of that light. Now, this is a thing you can measure, right? So Einstein says that star should move a certain amount. But, of course, the sun is really bright, so you can't see stars during the day. So you have to wait until a solar eclipse. And eclipses are rare, and they're in inconvenient places on the Earth. So you have to set up all your equipment just so, in just the right place, to try to capture this image just when you want it.
There are some scientists who try to, I don't want to say destroy Einstein's theory, but they try to prove that it's not accurate. Is that still ongoing?
Well, it's complicated, I guess, is the answer. So the first thing to say is that over the last 100 years, general relativity has passed every single test we have asked of it, and physicists are constantly coming up with new ways to test the theory, and it always passes. It's an amazing thing. All that said, we know that relativity can't be the end theory of the universe. And the reason we know that is because there's a rival theory, quantum physics, which has also passed every test we have asked of it, but disagrees completely about the nature of the universe. That is, the universe can't both be relativistic and quantum. So we're at this very puzzling situation where we've got two fantastically successful theories, relativity and quantum physics, that disagree with each other on this fundamental level. And the hope is that things like string theory can help explain why it is that we have these two theories. But so far, it's still a mystery.
When we come back in a moment, Matt, let's talk about the English astronomer and physics expert A.S. Eddington that not a lot of people know about because he did play a key role in a lot of this. So we'll talk about him, get your take on the rest of Einstein. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with Matt Stanley. We're talking about Einstein's war, how relativity triumphed amid the vicious nationalism of World War I. Truly amazing that we had minds that functioned the way they did in those days, because we're living the way we are right now because of that. We are back with Matt Stanley, his book, Einstein's War. Matt, I take it that is a young Albert Einstein on the cover of the book?
It is indeed. Not that young, right? He's in his 30s, which is when the events of the book take place.
Hey, my birthday's tomorrow. 30's young.
But I think it's actually important to think about the youngish, middle-aged Einstein, right? He's not the young, heroic Einstein trying to change the world with his ideas. He's not the old, wizardly Einstein who everybody respects. He's got some work under his belt, but people don't really know who he is yet.
Exactly. Now, there was an English astronomer physicist by the name of A.S. Eddington. How does he fit into this equation?
Eddington is the key to Einstein becoming famous.
Really?
I like to think about it. So Einstein finishes his theory of general relativity in 1915, but nobody hears about it. And that's because Einstein is in Berlin, and he's blockaded by the war. So his ideas can't get out. Remember, the scientists have become nationalistic. They're not willing to talk to each other anymore. So the one place that Einstein can go to while the war is raging is the Netherlands, where he has some friends. So the Netherlands are neutral, so he's able to go back and forth. And he has a friend there, an astronomer named Wilhelm de Sitter, who learns relativity from Einstein and then decides to try and send relativity on to England. And he sends a letter to the Royal Astronomical Society, thinking there might be somebody there who's interested. And the person who opens the envelope is this guy who you're just mentioning, Arthur Stanley Eddington. And Eddington is an astronomer. He's a physicist. He's not particularly interested in things like relativity, but what he is interested in is German science.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because he is a Quaker and a pacifist, and he feels very strongly that science needs to be international and to rise above all of the terrible things that have come with the war. So when Eddington sees this theory, he realizes its scientific importance, but he says, even better, Einstein is also a pacifist. So the relativity in Einstein sort of become a symbol for him of how to bring science above the war.
His Einstein's theory of E equals MC squared, kind of break that down for us. Of course, you know, most of us who, you know, studied physics in school know that it's energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. But what does that mean?
Well, that's a good question, because equations don't speak for themselves. You actually need to sit down and think about them a bit. So the C squared is what's called a constant. It's just a number. So it doesn't change at all in the situations where you use this. So the important thing about that equation is saying that energy equals mass. But it's not really clear what that means either. So what we usually say is that E equals MC squared tells us that you can convert mass into energy and also energy into mass. So that what we think of as two separate things, mass and energy, are actually just manifestations of some deeper stuff, this mass-energy equivalence. So the equation is a way for us to sort out the different kinds of stuff in the universe and figure out how we can convert one thing into another.
Is it also a formula for how much energy a nuclear bomb would have?
It is, yeah. So the way nuclear bombs work is they convert a little bit of matter, a little bit of mass, into energy. So E equals MC squared is what lets you calculate how much energy will be released by a given amount of mass.
Now, he was a scientist. Einstein was a scientist. Was he a believer in God or not? I keep hearing conflicting stories about that.
This is a an interesting thing, actually, because you can make a case for it either way. So what happens is this. So by the 1920s, 1930s, Einstein is the most famous person in the world. So people ask him about everything. So they say, Professor Einstein, what do you think about jazz? What do you think about modern art? And eventually somebody says, Professor Einstein, do you believe in God? And he says, yes. So this gets reported in the papers, and then Einstein's friends write to him and say, I didn't know you believed in God. And Einstein says, well, hang on a sec. What I mean by God is the rational orderliness of the universe, like the fact that the universe makes sense. He says, that's what I mean by God. And he explicitly says, I don't believe in a personal God, right? I don't believe in an old man with a beard judging.
Sitting on a cloud.
Yeah, exactly right. He says, Einstein says, that's totally wrong. Well, really, so he says, I'm a deeply religious person in the sense that God is this orderliness of the universe. So one of the interesting things that happens sort of historically is that both religious believers and atheists claim Einstein for their own, and there's an important sense in which they're both right.
I think so, too, and I tend to believe Einstein's portion of that, where he talks about orderliness in the universe and everything else, that had to come from some kind of intelligence, because you just don't roll the dice and have what you have. It just doesn't happen that way.
That's right, and that's a metaphor that Einstein returns to a lot, which is that he says, you know, God does not play dice, by which he wants to stress that the true nature of the universe is not random and crazy, but it's orderly and predictable.
Now, once he basically stopped going to Germany and he stayed here, were the Nazis out to get him? Did they want his head?
Yes, at least in the metaphorical and intellectual sense, right? It's not like they were sending spies to assassinate him. But there was a focused anti-Einstein movement within Nazi science. It was actually called Deutsche Physik. And the argument was that there was Jewish science and there was Nazi science. So the idea is that Einstein's Jewish blood sort of corrupted the physics he did. So if you learned physics in 1930s Germany, you learned it through this Nazi-tinged lens of explaining why Einstein had to be wrong.
I bet he had people, though, watching him to make sure he was okay.
Einstein?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there were people not just watching Einstein to make sure he was okay, but also because he was a suspicious person to the FBI. So Hoover was worried that Einstein was a communist.
Really?
So Einstein was followed his entire time. He was living here in the U.S., and he has a very substantial FBI file, which is interesting reading.
Hoover was paranoid about everybody, wasn't he?
Everybody.
So Einstein died. He had like a rupture or something in his intestine or stomach, something like that happened?
Yeah, I'd have to check specifically, but it's almost certainly just natural causes of old age. You know, he was lived to a ripe old age.
He had some kind of operation in the 40s, and I guess something happened later on when he died in 1955, I think.
Yeah, so he did have that problematic operation, and this was an era when surgery was a little less standardized than it is today, so it wasn't unusual for people to have complications that would last for years and years.
Matt, when you were writing the book Einstein's War, what did you learn about Einstein that you did not know before?
One of the fascinating things I found was, Einstein now, his name is a noun, right? You can't go anywhere in the world where someone won't recognize his name or his face. So it's hard to imagine that there was ever a time not like that. But even a couple of years after he finishes his theory of relativity, but before the end of the war, nobody knows who he is. He's a person of almost no significance. So my favorite little anecdote for this is in 1918, so this is 3 years after he finishes his theory of general relativity. He goes to give a lecture on relativity, and not enough people show up to keep it, so they cancel the lecture. So there were not a dozen people. This would happen to be in Switzerland. There were not a dozen people in Switzerland who cared enough about Einstein to go hear him talk.
Interesting. And you know what also is just fascinating? When somebody screws up, you always hear somebody else go, way to go, Einstein.
Yeah, that's when you know you've made it, is when your name is an insult, right?
Exactly. Einstein's war. Now, when the atomic bomb went off, he was alive still, obviously.
Yeah.
What kind of reaction did he have to that?
He was horrified because there's this sense in which, you know, he wrote the letter to FDR that jump-started the Manhattan Project. There's a sense in which the bomb is based in his physics. So even though he didn't work on the bomb himself, he felt this deep personal responsibility, and people associated it with him as well. So he felt that because there was a sense in which, you know, he had contributed to this terrible new kind of weapon, that it was going to be part of his job to fix it as well. So he tries to, you know, ban nuclear weapons and provide for some kind of non-nuclear future. And of course, you know, we know he failed, but he dedicates the last years of his life to sort of undoing what he had done.
I mean, did he ever get married? Did he have a family? Were his parents stuck in Germany when he was here? What happened?
So Einstein marries twice. He gets divorced from his first wife during World War I, so during the story I tell in the book, and actually marries his first cousin, also has the last name of Einstein at the time. So he has two children from his first marriage and two stepchildren from his second. And eventually they all come to live in the United States as well. So Einstein's grandchildren are actually still alive here in the
United States. I was going to say, we've got Einstein offspring in this country.
Yep. One of them is actually, if I remember right, he's an engineer. And I've got to think that that was very brave of him to go into an engineering field with the name Einstein.
It's genetics.
Yeah.
I would love to interview one of these people. Wouldn't you?
Yeah, that would be great. I've never met him.
I mean, would they have ever... Einstein dies at 55. Well, I don't know. Were they around then?
They would have been young children, I suppose. Yes, I don't know if they remember him or not. But, you know, it's interesting. These days, you know, these years, right now, I regularly meet elderly people who met Einstein when they were children. And in a few years, those people are going to be gone. So it's right now is the last few people on the planet with direct memories of meeting Einstein.
Why was his hair so wild?
Oh. he was not interested in personal grooming. This is an issue that goes back at least to when he's married to his first wife. He doesn't like toothbrushes. He doesn't like hairbrushes. He doesn't like worrying about what kind of socks to wear. But even though that was the case, that is, that he wasn't big on hygiene, he was irresistible to women.
Was this his personality, or what was it?
Apparently so. I mean, his
intellect.
Right from when he was a young man, he greatly enjoyed the company of women, and even, you know, throughout his life, he is both married and has a girlfriend or a mistress on the side.
Albert!
I know it. Not the way we think about him.
No, not at all. You always think of him, you know, behind a chalkboard doing his thing. And...
Exactly.
Did he have personal friends, like other scientists and people like that?
Yeah, and they were deeply important to him. His social skills, putting women to the side, his social skills were not great, so he did not make friends easily. So once he did make friends with someone, he became very intensely attached to them. So he typically had friends that would that lasted his entire life, even if sometimes he had deep, deep philosophical or political disagreements with those people. So for instance, one of his good friends when he's living in Berlin is a guy named Fritz Haber, who is one of the great chemists of all time. He figures out how to make artificial fertilizer. So literally, most of us would not be alive here if not for Fritz Haber. But Haber is also the guy who invents chemical weapons.
Yeah. Okay.
So he's responsible for unbelievable suffering and death. And Einstein, the pacifist, somehow still maintains a friendship with this guy.
He apparently said to his old friend Linus Pauling that he made one great mistake in his life when he sent that letter you mentioned to President Roosevelt recommending the atomic bombs be made. But he said there was justification. The danger was that the Germans would make them too. And he was probably right.
Yeah, it's you know, it's come 1933 or so, you know, as fascism erupts across Europe, the European scientific community is devastated because anyone with a quarter Jewish heritage, or married to someone with a quarter Jewish heritage, or was just suspicious of looking too Jewish, were chased out of Central Europe. So this huge wave of scientists like Einstein flee Europe, and most of them end up in the United States. And through the great irony is they're the ones who build the atomic bomb, right? The Manhattan Project could not have happened if not for all of these scientists that
That's right.
Nazis.
He was a huge supporter for African Americans. Huge.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, along the lines of what we were just talking about, that was one of the reasons Hoover didn't trust him, is Einstein gets to New Jersey and he sees segregation in action. And he says explicitly, he says, this is the same way I was treated as a Jew in Nazi Germany. And he says, I do not intend to be quiet about it. He has this great phrase where he says, segregation is a problem of white people and not black people. And it's a problem that white people have to solve.
Did he play music? Was he a musician, too?
Yeah, he was taught music by his mother. She was a pianist and wanted someone to play music with, so she starts him on violin lessons when he's very young. And at first, he really doesn't like it because, you know, if you've ever studied an instrument, you have to learn your scales, you have to learn your fingering. There's all this mechanical stuff you have to learn before you get to the good stuff. And he hates that. There's nothing Einstein hates as much as having to do repetitive things for no particular purpose. So he's actually cool on it for some years until he's a teenager, and then he hears Beethoven for the first time, and then he, as he describes it, he says, I fell in love. And once he falls in love with it, then the violin becomes this this crucial kind of escape for him. It's a place he can express himself emotionally. It's a place he can express himself socially, like he goes to parties and plays the violin. And it becomes music is an important bonding thing for him and many of his friends too.
What kind of a loss was it for the United States when he died?
Well, by 1954, you know, he was past his prime in terms of science, right? He wasn't producing great scientific papers anymore.
Okay.
So I don't think we lost out on the grand unified theory or anything like that. But what he was by that point was the symbol of science. He was literally what people thought of when they thought about scientific authority and sort of the deep wisdom of the universe. So we lost a sage, right? He was the person who we trusted to tell us the truth about things.
What do you think Matthew would be saying about the state of the world today had he been here?
Well, I think, unfortunately, we could take a lot of his letters from World War One and just update the date.
Just change the date, yeah.
And they would sound pretty familiar. Mm-hmm. You know, he constantly complained about the evils of nationalism and how patriotism drives people to do terrible things, and somehow the most brilliant people he knew, once they became sort of inflamed with nationalist passion, would do the most terrible things.
Where did he live generally here?
Princeton, New Jersey.
New Jersey.
Yep, so you can still go to Princeton and visit his house on Mercer Street.
Was he a professor at all at the university?
He was at the Institute for Advanced Study, which is technically not part of the university, but it's kind of a think tank in the same town. So he was a professor there, but he didn't teach classes. He had people who we think of as his students who would go and sort of do research projects with him.
Okay, stay with us, Matt. We're going to take another hour of phone calls with you from our amazing listeners. Matt Stanley, our special guest, his book, Einstein's War. Your calls are next on Coast to Coast AM.